Charles Bukowski was born in Germany, but he lived in Southern California pretty much all of his life. And it's hard to imagine a more American writer. Yet, his work has inspired a number of European filmmakers, the most recent of which is Bent Hamer, a Norwegian writer and director. His adaptation of Bukowski's second novel, Factotum, is opening a week from this Friday at Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the AMC Empire. It stars Matt Dillon as Bukowski's alter ego, Henry Chinaski, along with Lily Taylor, Marissa Tomei, and Fisher Stevens. And joining me now are Matt Dillon, Lily Taylor, and Bent Hamer. Welcome.
Hello.
Great.
Bent, there have been adaptations by Belgian, French, and now a Norwegian filmmaker. Is Bukowski read a lot in Europe?
Yes, I actually think he's more popular in Europe than in the U.S. Read a lot in the 80s and 70s. I don't know today. But I think it goes up and down, and he's really a classic, so people find him.
What do Europeans get out of him? Do they see him as a quintessentially American writer, or do they connect to the other themes, especially the addictive themes, for example?
He's probably very American, but I mean, all good writers have something universal about their writing, so I think it's very easy to recognize and feel connected to what he's writing. And I would also say, even if you live this kind of low life that he's describing and lived, I think it's a lot of things that you can recognize. It's a very strong smell of human being.
Well, you must have been very pleased when A.O. Scott of the New York Times wrote, "There have been a lot of Bukowski adaptations. This is the one I like best. It captures the kind of soulful, pickled spirit of Bukowski at its best." Matt, Charles Bukowski published something like 45 books. Had you read anything before you took this role?
Yeah, I actually had read most of Bukowski's novels and short stories in my early 20s. Once I read Hot Water Music, I read a short story from Hot Water Music, I was hooked, and I just read most of it. And I think it was probably right about the time when Barfly was made into a film, when I really stopped reading him, moved on to other authors, and really didn't look back, although I loved his work, and I probably read as much Bukowski as anybody else, until Jim and Bent approached me about doing the film, which took me, it was a surprise. I was intrigued by the idea of it. My first reaction was that this probably wouldn't work, and I'm really not the right physical type.
Well, he was short, and you are tall. He was kind of squat. You were.
Well, I don't know. He was sort of ectomorphic in some ways. He's kind of lanky for a guy. I don't know his height actually, but he had that kind of, you know, I like the kind of defeated physical quality that he had, as if like the physical world had sort of, you know, he'd sort of surrendered to it. You know.
Did you see any connections between his character and some of the troubled characters you played 20 years ago as a teen in movies like Rumblefish and The Outsiders?
Well, there was something that paralleled a little bit of the character that I think I played in Drugstore Cowboy, but I really saw it as a very different thing than anything I've done before. The way I approached it was different, you know, as well. You know, I didn't really think of it. I thought of it as its unique thing. I had such admiration for Bukowski as a writer.
But this has to be a difficult part because you're playing it mostly drunk, you know, and drunk is a hard thing to play, isn't it? You can't just stumble around and slur your words.
Well, he's really a maintenance drinker, isn't he? He's kind of a pro, you know. So I think the disaster would have been if I played it like Arthur. Like the Arthur drunk, like, you know, I think so. The idea is really not to play drunk so much as to just allow yourself to sort of remember what that's like. And, you know, I think that's sort of what happens with these things. You often hear about heroin addicts, sort of it's a maintenance thing, you know.
And Lily, you also play a drunk who drinks for maintenance.
Yeah.
He, along the way, Henry Chinaski falls in love, kind of. I'm not exactly sure what their relationship is with your character, Jan, another lost soul But she seems to need emotional attachment to lift her out of her despair along with the alcohol, and that's not something he's going to give her.
No, I think, though, when you're drinking like that, I think your hopes and desires and dreams are so clouded in that murky haze of the booze and the lostness, and then maybe about 5 a.m. you're realizing it's not going to happen, but then you start drinking again and the hopes return, and that's what keeps happening with Hank.
Had you read Bukowski before you took on the role?
Yeah, I read Bukowski, which I'm finding a lot of people pick him up at a certain point in their life, you know, late teens, early 20s, and I feel like Bukowski at least helped me get to a certain place, and then I didn't need his help anymore.
A lot of women are uncomfortable with Bukowski. He's been accused of being a misogynist in the way he depicts female characters, although you don't get that feeling from watching the women in this film. I don't know whether you, Bent, and Jim Stark, you wrote the script together, whether you changed the female characters or whether they are just as much fringe characters in society as Hank is. Mm.
He did a lot of things, I suppose, that I don't like, but I think it fits better into the cliché, into the myth about him, that you highlight that side of him. But he had many other sides too, and I've been talking a lot to Linda Bukowski, his widow, and that was also one of the challenges by trying to adapt the book and a life like this, and try to see something in between the lines, give it some warmth. The people are living on the edge, and I think that's closer also to the reality. And obviously, we also try to stick to his universe to make it authentic. He wrote always. I mean, people say that it's all experienced, but he used. It's not about. Bukowski, it's about Henry Chernaski, his alter ego. And for us, that was also the main key to approach the character from Matt. And I think still we were scared to death to do it in a way, because he's so visible, it's so hard to get him out of your view. But to adapt the book, you have to throw the book away and try to stick to the essence, the soul of the story.
My guests are Bent Hamer, who is the director and co-writer of Factotum, which opens a week from this Friday at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the AMC Empire. And also here are the two stars of the film, or two of the, I guess I would say, what, three or four stars? But yeah. Matt Dillon plays Henry Chernaski, who is pretty much on the screen all the time. Lily Taylor, the major love of his life. Marissa Tomei is also quite wonderful as another woman in your life. Fisher Stevens, your gambling buddy. Mm. And what about the casting? Did you immediately think of Matt and Lily when you were casting this film?
It has been a very long process to make this film happen. And actually, the stars, as you said, is friends or friends of friends. So that was the way to do it. And it's a beautiful way. Of course, you don't go to a friend if you don't think they are the best. But it happened this time that we really wanted the people that we had some access to through friends.
They say the key to any success in film and theater is casting. I think it's 80% of the job. And if you get the right people, you just trust them to do what they do. How much did you understand about this character, Lily, when you were reading the script? Did you know somebody like Jan ever?
I do. I've known women like Jan, and I don't even know if I can name them, but I know them. But you know what's funny is I don't think Bukowski's a misogynist, actually. If anything, maybe a sexist, but maybe not even that. He's just an artist who's expressing himself and who's confused at times or whatever, messy. But I didn't know what there would be for me in it, you know. And I was pleasantly surprised as I read it and realized she was quite a complicated woman. And I love the tension that Bent found in the movie with you know, the classic thing of the drunk who keeps trying, or the lovers who fight but love each other, all that There's just a lot of tension in the movie.
Well, Jan is really smart, and so is Henry, and yet she works as a maid in a hotel. I guess that's the job she holds longest. Henry just works at one terrible job after another.
One dead-end job after another.
And on top of it all, has absolutely no interest in these jobs. It makes it clear to the people he works for that he doesn't respect them and the job. But he has to keep on going out and getting jobs because that's the only way he's going to survive or pay for a room. I don't know whether, because you've been acting all your life, whether that's something you can even understand, but I'm sure you've been in some movies where you thought,
yeah, absolutely.
Just like Henry, I got to get out of here.
Well, I think it's what I kind of liked about, you know, the script is that he's really sort of, you know, he could care less when he gets fired from each job, and he can't hold down a job. But there's not a lack of ambition there, you know. He isn't this kind of nihilistic guy. He really has this ambition to be successful as a writer, and he states that. There's that scene when he walks out on Jan. He says what a person needs in life is success of one form or another. You know, she's saying you need love. He's saying I need success, and he walks out.
In fact, she is disappointed when he does well at the track and has a lot of money because suddenly he's feeling better about himself. He's feeling like a success of sorts.
Dysfunction Junction.
But there are some really funny work scenes. He's constantly screwing up, but one of the jobs is to clean the nose of a giant stone statue. And so this is actually a film, you know, you'd think it was because of the theme that it would be filled with despair, but there's a lot of funny stuff in it.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, Bukowski saw life he saw the middle of things. So I think he, in a funny way, he had this, you know, this self-deprecating sense of humor. I think he saw life as a comedy, not as a tragedy. And I think that's what I responded to in Bukowski. And, you know, he's not, it's funny, Bent was the other day, he talked about how Hank really isn't a character who changes throughout the film, but I think he's complex enough that we discover more about him as we go along.
But we know that he's going to have success ultimately.
Mm.
Because he becomes a famous writer. We're only seeing him at the time where he keeps on getting rejection slips. But the film ends with his first story being accepted by Black Sparrow Press.
Mm.
So we know that he's going to change. Did he ever quit drinking? You know, Ben?
No, he didn't.
So he's an alcoholic to the end.
Yeah, well, once again, to refer to his widow, Linda, she thinks that he wasn't an alcoholic, so maybe that's right too. I mean, the only person who can tell that is probably Bukowski and his dad.
Well, I guess it depends on how you define an alcoholic.
Yes,
if it's somebody
exactly.
who drinks morning, noon, and night, then he must have been an alcoholic.
Well, I have to be a little bit philosophical also.
I mean, I see him as, you know, it fits, you know, to call him an alcoholic when in describing him that he is an alcoholic. You know, there's another thing that I discovered that I didn't realize. When I read Bukowski in those early years, I responded to the bawdiness and the irreverent humor. But that I see him as a working class hero in this particular story. I never thought of him as a worker. You know, he's a guy who showed up every day, you know, even after he had success. I think he worked in the post office so he could get his pension. And I think that's very telling about who he was, you know. He sort of becomes a voice for all those people in those dead-end jobs.
Well, many people would not call him a hero, and yet the film doesn't judge him at all. It simply presents what he does as the facts. And that was, I'm sure, something that you were very careful about. Were the people who wanted you to be critical of this kind of lifestyle?
No, I think that was also part of why it took so long time. We wanted to make the film we would like to see. And of course, it's like Lily said earlier on, there are no structure in his books. I mean, that's good news too, because you can cut from one scene to another scene without any problems, even from one book to another book.
In fact, you included, this is based on Factotum, but you've included things from any number of other writings.
Yeah, poetry mainly then, from other books. And I mean, the main thing about the script, if you talk to a script doctor, is that the main character is changing. But I mean, he's not changing. That's also the essence of Bukowski. You can't talk to this man. So that was kind of hard. And people also had some comments about people don't drink today. They do drugs, but that's just.
I don't think that's true.
That's not true.
Judging on just what I've seen, not on any personal experience, that's just not true. My guests are Bent Hamer, who is the director and co-writer of Factotum, which opens at two theaters here in New York a week from this Friday. Also, it stars Matt Dillon and Lily Taylor. Marissa Tomei and Fisher Stevens and others are also in the film. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Charles Bukowski has been adapted, or his work has been adapted into a number of films. Probably the best known in America is Barfly, where Mickey Rourke played his alter ego, Henry Chinaski. Now there is a new film in which Matt Dillon is Henry Chinaski. It's called Factotum, and it opens a week from this Friday at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the AMC Empire. Matt Dillon is here along with his co-star Lily Taylor, also in the cast Marissa Tomei, Fisher Stevens, and others. And Lily Taylor is here, and so is Bent Hamer, who directed and co-wrote. Did you see that you saw the film Barfly? So was Mickey Rourke's performance in the back of your head at any time?
Not at all. You know, I saw Barfly. It was right sort of at the end of that period of time when I was reading Bukowski. I saw it when it first came out. I remember enjoying it. Mickey was a friend of mine.
And he did a great job, I thought.
Yeah, I enjoyed the film. But it was not at all on my mind while we were making the film. The one thing, you know, that was really beneficial, and I had lunch with Barbe Schroeder, and I said, listen, I owe you a debt of gratitude, because Barbe had done a series of interviews with Bukowski, which, you know, was really helpful source material for me, you know, and sort of getting inside the character. It was really helpful to me, you know.
Do you research usually when you're taking on a role?
Yeah, especially with something like this. It's, you know, you're so fortunate when you're dealing with somebody who's based on a real person that there's such great source material. I mean, one of the things is that Linda Bukowski was extremely helpful in pointing certain things out to me. And one of the things that she said was there was this sort of this misconception about him that he was this, you know, that he was dirty, that he was filthy, that he was a slob. And something that really bothered Hank in reality. And in fact, she said he was very neat. There was something very, he had some order, some discipline, and he was not dirty. He was clean.
And you get that across in the film. No matter how bad his situation, he always seems to try to pull himself together, at least get his hair combed,
exactly.
Have his face washed.
Yeah, and that was something that sort of goes against, you know, an actor's instinct is like, if you're going to play a Skid Row bum who ends up homeless, you got to, you know, rub your face in the gutter, you know. And this really helped me, this one little thing that Linda said.
Do you also research characters? I can't imagine you doing much research for Jan.
Right. It's sort of like I try to listen at the beginning to see what I need to do. And this one was saying no. This one was saying just get out of the head and just get into the gut.
But the important part here is also working out the way you interact with Matt.
Exactly. But part of that was just getting into a real open place, you know, and coming from instincts as opposed to the intellect. I felt like the research would have gotten me too into the head.
Now, this film is shot in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I was thinking that instead of Down and Out in Paris and London, you could have called it Down and Out in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But But why? Why there? Are there no places that would work these days in Los Angeles and San Pedro?
Yes, probably. But it was a little bit too complicated for our budget to do it in Los Angeles.
The old days, you used to go shoot everything in Hollywood. Now you try to shoot as much out of Hollywood to save money.
Yeah, mainly that was the first. And we had a producer up there that wanted us very much to come, and a very supported film board. And I mean, it's so much easier to do it there. I mean, the whole city, or the two cities, twin cities, was very helpful. We got offices from the police department, and I mean, everybody was helpful, so that was easy. And luckily, I also found out that it might have been better to shoot it. They want to shoot the film in kind of no time atmosphere, and we could find, like in the book, there are a dog biscuit factory. How to find that? It's not easy, even up in Minnesota. But we could find a pickle factory, mm-hmm. and it was a lot of old-fashioned factories, which fits very well into these kind of images that we want to establish the atmosphere of the film as a no-time atmosphere.
And buildings that have faded messages that were once yeah. painted on them that really do give a sense yeah. of the seedy side of town. So, is this the first time you've ever shot a film in Minneapolis, St. Paul? Does it really matter?
Well, I'll tell you, when he told me that he was looking at Minneapolis, St. Paul, I was surprised because I knew Bukowski to be very much a Los Angeles chronicler, you know. And
that sounds more Garrison Keillor to me.
yeah, exactly, right. And but what was really wonderful was that there's so much baggage in a way in Los Angeles. There's a lot of baggage with Bukowski, which was one of my concerns about going into it, but also in Los Angeles, you know. In a way, it was nice to be able to step away from that world. And Minneapolis in the summer is a great place to work. I can tell you, I've shot there in the winter, 40 below. I ended up getting the flu. Immediately, one of the drivers was taking me to the doctor, and we just started the film. And he said, "Oh, if you get a flu in Minneapolis, you usually have it for the whole season." And he said, "Old Jack Lemmon got pneumonia while he was making Grumpy Old Men." And I was like, "Oh, this is what I'm in for." But it was night and day. Working there in the summer was wonderful.
Well, you also have Los Angeles baggage. Had you shot Crash before or after this?
Before. Crash was shot before this.
So that was playing a more troubled character than Henry Chinaski.
Well, in one way, more troubled. You know, it's interesting because, like Bent was talking about script doctors and structure, and the sort of core of that film is self-discovery with so many of the characters. You know, they sort of come to some, you know, moment of clarity, you know, and the factotum isn't about that, but it is about discovery, like maybe for the viewer to discover more about these individuals, the complexity of these characters. Sort of I love the way that Hank and Jan interact with each other, because it runs the gamut, really.
But it's interesting, as you said earlier, Bent, none of them really change. You know that 10 years from that time, Jan will be pretty much what she is. She's not suddenly going to be discovered as having a great voice and become a major singing star. And Bukowski, no matter whether he becomes a famous writer or not, will always be that guy, because he's psychologically that guy. So these are not people who go through real major discoveries other than discovering that they kind of are who they are.
Yeah, there was one small thing change. Point in the film where he was published. The whole film is about his younger days when he struggled to be published.
At the very end, we find out that he's going to be published. He doesn't even know because he doesn't have an address.
In the book, he's getting this acceptance slip from Black Sparrow. But I like so much that he don't know it. It gets in his mail to the landlady, and he moved out from that house already.
Do films like Crash and Factotum get you better roles? Because since then you have Yumi and Dupree and Herbie Fully Loaded.
Well, you know, you do films for different reasons. I enjoy doing comedy, and those are, you know, I think the entire I think the craft service budget on You, Me, and Dupree was probably more than the entire budget on Factotum. But I can tell you, for me, the greatest experiences I've had have been doing films like this on location, independent films with a small crew. Nobody's getting rich, but, you know, if you've got a filmmaker with a vision, as Bent has a vision, I think it makes all the difference in the world, you know, that we have a filmmaker with a vision. We can help to facilitate that. As an actor, you can't. It doesn't get better than that, really.
And Lily, Variety once dubbed you the first lady of the indie cinema. So this film is a classic version of that, although you have done more mainstream movies.
Just a couple.
Ransom.
And Haunting. That's it.
That's it?
Pretty much. But
I read somewhere that you said about working in some of the more typical Hollywood films. I just found that I couldn't do it. I read the script, and even if you forced me to say the lines, the words just wouldn't come out.
Yeah, like the Fonz. I felt a little like I couldn't say, sorry, like the Fonz. You know, it's like, I'm just realizing that I love the freedom of the independence, and that's, I've been realizing the past few days talking about it, that I feel like, it's almost like I feel like we're children and our parents are gone, and we get to do what we want. We don't have anybody breathing down our neck, and I love when a director has autonomy.
Now, Factotum premiered April 14, 2005, so it's been around a little while. It was at a film festival in Trondheim, Norway, and I understand it's the first movie in the world to be shown with a 4K digital cinema projector. Now, I don't know what that means, but how significant is that, Bent?
Well, I'm probably the wrong one to ask, too. But, well, we scanned, the film is scanned in 2K, and this was the new Canon from Sony that was 4K. And it, I heard that for years now. Now we have to see, it's a new Canon. And it never was good for me, but this time it was really fantastic. It was fantastic. You recognize everything you had done.
So digital at this point is pretty much comparable to shooting in film?
Not to shoot it still, but to show it at least. That was I don't know too much about it. I know a lot about the problems, but that's not for here. But it was a beautiful image, as I must say. I was really surprised.
Do you think you're going to be, since you do so many indies, Lily, have you been shooting a lot in digital these days?
No, I haven't. Not as much. It's funny, it's digital did not take off the way I thought it was going to.
I think it will.
But yeah, I don't think it's... it's probably not... It's not really ready yet, I don't
think.
Yeah, at least for to shoot with. I think in terms of transfers, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's done great things, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, amazing.
Well, later Bukowski started writing a lot of poetry and became fairly famous as a poet. Three of his poems were adapted into songs by a Norwegian singer-songwriter, Kristin Asbjørnsen. I would not have guessed that she was Norwegian. You have an accent, Ben, but she does not when she's singing.
Yeah, but I'm not singing either. I mean, maybe that's a little bit
do
easier.
Do you sing with an American accent?
We have to have a traveling, a traveling subtitle underneath him.
No, she. Yeah, I think she has been singing in English for a long time. But and she has been living in England as well, I think. But she's fantastic, and I think the obvious way to go, maybe because my co-partner on the project, Jim Stark, worked with Tom Waits on the earlier Jarmusch films. I thought it's very much a scene from Chinaski's point of view, male point of view, probably. So I wanted something feminine, a feminine part of it. And so I thought Kristin with this, something in between, she's a kind of female Tom Waits for me, something in between her and maybe Janis Joplin or something. So that was a choice I wanted badly to be a part of the atmosphere I wanted to create.
Will your next film be English language, or are you going back to Norwegian films?
I don't know. I like to see myself as very open-minded, but the person that can say no. I don't pick countries. I mean, I pick scripts, so if there is a good script, I read scripts in English all the time. I wrote a new script myself that's probably going to be shot in Norway in February, but that's in Norwegian.
And Lily, you have something else? I saw you recently on stage. You're going to go back to do more theater?
Well, I just finished a play, so that's my play for the year, because that's about all I can afford. And and I just finished something just a couple nights ago, and now I'm just going to relax a little bit.
No more HBO shows?
Not right now.
Matt, you're all over the place.
Well, you know, after this, I really, the only thing I'm going to do is get back and finish a rewrite that I've done several rewrites on.
Because you want to do more directing?
Well, I'm sort of like, I'm at a point of no return on this project. You know, you get to a certain point where you have to see it through, and I really do enjoy directing. I also enjoy working with filmmakers, filmmakers with a vision again. But, I had a great experience with that, and I'd like to do that, do some more of that.
Well, you've worked with some of the greatest directors of our time, and I'm sure you learned from them. And Lily, you have as well. Would you ever imagine directing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm adapting something now, and I don't know when, but I know I will.
That means that, Bent, you have to become an actor. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Bent Hamer, who is the director and co-writer, along with Jim Stark, of Factotum, which opens a week from this Friday at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the AMC Empire. And it stars Matt Dillon and Lily Taylor, also in the film, Marissa Tomei and Fisher Stevens and others. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Leonard.
Thank you.
Great.